Thank you. I noticed that this workshop has been very heavy towards number theory, so I'm going to disappoint you all and have no number theory at all. Okay. So I'm glad to hear that. You're not going to be disappointed. So I'm going to basically wrap up three papers here. So it's going to be very high level. You're not going to see any proofs or anything, but I'm going to try to give you a flavor of what message recognition protocols are and what's the flavor of the new designs we have for them. So a paper is joined with Douglas Stinson. A paper is joined between Ian Goldberg and Douglas Stinson, and then Serge Bodena is my supervisor at EPFL. So that part is pretty new, like 2 weeks ago or something. Okay, so this is the outline for today. I'm going to give you the background information. We're going to look very briefly over some previous message recognition protocols, particularly one that's called the Jane Doe protocol. And then we're going to see, well, this Jane Doe protocol is based on hash chains. We're going to see a message recognition protocol design without using hash chains. And then we're going to see one that is based on pseudo-random functions. Okay, so what's the notion of message recognition protocol? So assume that we have Alice and Bob, our beloved characters in cryptography, and they're two people, not computers for now. They meet in the party, but for the first time. So they don't know each other. They're just completely two strangers. They meet for the first time in a party. They make a bet, and then they go off. A few days later, a week later, it turns out that Alice actually wins. And then Bob receives a message claiming to be from Alice, saying that this is my bank account number. Go and deposit that $1 million that we bet on to this bank account number. So how can Bob be sure that the message that is claimed to be sent from Alice is actually from Alice, whoever Alice was? So they were complete strangers. They didn't have any credentials to exchange or anything. So we have no public key infrastructure, nothing to certify who Alice is. Alice just comes and claims, I'm Alice, and you have to take her word for that. So more formally, we have two small devices, like, let's say, moats or network, in a sensor network, or something that, you know, doesn't have that much computational power or memory. They meet in an environment that allows them to send authentic information to each other, but not confidential, just authentic. So going back to that party example, all the people around you are hearing what you're saying, but you're sure that it's authentic, so it's not confidential, but it's authentic. Now, Alice wants Bob to recognize the messages that are sent from her, and there's an adversary, like our usual scenarios. Eve is trying to make Bob accept a message that was sent from Eve as something that was sent from Alice. And obviously, we call a message recognition protocol secure if Eve's attempts are detected by either Alice or Bob. Okay, so I already alluded that, you know, some of the techniques, why they wouldn't be possible here. Well, public key techniques, they need some authentic information to be pre-deployed. We may need a trusted third party and computational power. These little devices may be just so constrained that we cannot handle public key computations, let's say. Also, secret key techniques need a secure channel, and we don't have that in this scenario. So in 2003, a paper by Wyrmuth, Kish, and Westhoff, sorry for the pronunciation, observed that, you know, in such an environment, achieving authentication may not even be possible. So they claim that, but they don't prove it, but they claim something like this, and they say all we can achieve is this recognition security. So the notion of recognition was first formalized here. But when we go back to the literature, we see that it existed. It just didn't give it a name. And we'll go over some prior work to 2003. So we're going to use these two notations from two-channel cryptography. This just one arrow is going to denote an insecure broadband channel, like your wireless channel, nothing fancy, nothing new. This double arrow is going to denote the authenticated but non-confidential channel, which is expensive, so it's a narrowband channel. You can think of this as you have your two devices, like a printer and your laptop. They don't have any cable between each other, but you can read something from your laptop and imprint it into the other device. So the user is going to be the narrowband channel, or laser, or infrared, or things like this. You can think of the narrowband channel as human-aided channels. So let's look at the literature and see that, we had Ross Anderson and his group propose a message recognition protocol in 98, but they just didn't call it that. They call it Guy Fawkes protocol. There's a story behind it. We won't have the time to say. If you know British history, you know this Guy Fawkes tried to blow up the parliament or set it on fire or something. Anyways, the two versions of the protocol needed time stamping or digital signatures, and as I just went over a few slides back, these two assumptions are just, we don't want to deal with those assumptions in this scenario. It's just our networks are just too ad hoc to assume that we can have a time stamping or digital signatures. Usually, you know, public, we don't want to deal with public key computations and all that. So in 2003, Mitchell proposed a protocol called remote user authentication. This is actually good in terms of assumptions, and you know, you don't need to deal with digital signatures or time stamping assumptions. You're using secret key computations like a MAC or a hash function, but you're using too many of them, and you don't want to just exhaust your little devices with 35 MACs times two, actually, so 70 MACs for each message that you want to authenticate. And then there comes Zero Common Knowledge Protocol. That's the paper that I talked about a few slides back, and formalizes this message recognition notion. And they call it the protocol Zero Common Knowledge. So Alice and Bob are basing their the protocol based on a zero common knowledge, so no common knowledge at all. So that was a good one, and they actually, we have a paper from 2005 that says it's very practical and it actually meets all the requirements that you need. Low computational power, low code space, low communication bandwidth, and low energy resources. So, okay, that's good, but hey, the same year we find an attack against that, and okay, so what are we going to do? In the same paper, they actually fixed the problem, and they called it the Jane Doe protocol. We're going to look at that protocol in more detail. So this protocol is using a hash function, but it's going from S to S, so that's a surprise for some people that are used to see a star here. We're using a MAC. And then, parameters are just typical parameters. S is 80, C is 30. We fix the number N to be the total number of messages that you want to authenticate. That's going to be the size of the hash chain that we're going to make. And then, what Alice and Bob need to do, they choose random parameters A0 and B0, and then they form these respective hash chains. A is for Alice, B is for Bob. We'll get to that. Okay. This is the initialization stage. So this is what I just explained. The AI and BI, they are going to exchange over the narrowband authentic channel, the AN and BN. And we're going to have N sessions, and we're going to move downwards in the hash chain. So they just revealed AN and BN. In the first round, we're going to work with AN minus 1 and BN minus 1. And this is the protocol. So on index I, so we have moved to AI, let's say. On input MI, Alice is going to find MAC of MI under AI, which is DI, send MI and DI to Bob. Well, Bob is going to receive the prime versions because the adversary can change them over this wireless channel. Now, Bob is going to send BI. Now, note that Alice has BI minus 1 from the previous session. And now she can verify if BI prime that she gets here is actually the preimage of BI plus 1. If so, Alice is going to accept the I and is going to send AI, which is going to note the same, have the same kind of recognizing property for Bob. Bob is going to receive AI and is going to verify if AI is actually, AI prime is actually the preimage of AI plus one that he got from the previous session. If so, he's going to accept this key and check if the MAC value and the message that he got here are actually, they actually belong to each other. If so, he's going to accept the message MI prime and the session I. So they have a security proof for this. It works well, but there's a catch. So here they're saying, if you didn't get the right B that didn't verify, wait for the new BI. The same here. If you didn't get one, the right AI, wait for the new AI. That actually poses some recoverability problem. And this is depicted here that Eve can trap Bob very easily. Just Eve is going to send random MI prime and DI prime to Bob. And Bob is going to move to the next time frame, whereas Alice is still in I plus one. Is not moving, and Bob is going to send BI, and hoping to get the right AI, but is not going to, because Eve chose them carefully, so this won't verify, and now Bob is going to wait for the new AI. He's going to wait for the new AI, just a second. And even if Alice comes along and sends a legitimate message, Bob has moved, so he's not waiting for an instruction here. He's waiting for an instruction here, and the protocol that they provide is not taking care of this recoverability problem. Yes. We started from A N here. But this is over the narrowband channel, which is authentic. This is the party. They met in person. Okay, so, well, similar to this, Eve can actually trap Alice, but that's not as interesting as this one, so I'm not going to show it. So there are issues that arise with the Jane Doe protocol. Recoverability that we just discussed, security assumptions that came earlier. Because you're using hash chains, we have to take it into consideration that the target, so here, if we want to find the preimage, if Eve wants to deceive Bob and find the preimage, this AI that we got from here was not random. AI is hashed to the power of I of A0, which A0 was random. So security assumptions are not standard. So that's something to deal with. We also have a fixed number of messages, so we don't have that much flexibility. Also, we have memory requirements for these tiny little devices that have to store a pair of hash chains for every communication they want to have, you know, for every user. Like Alice wants to talk to Bob, there's a pair. Wants to talk to Oscar, there's another pair. So there's things to take care of. Now, let's see what we have to add to this. We prove that, well, first of all, we looked at the literature, and all of these protocols are interactive. So why not non-interactive message recognition protocols? Well, there's a reason, because we could prove that there's an equivalence, so a one-to-one correspondence between non-interactive MRPs and digital signature schemes with message recovery, and you can actually, you know, do with a little trick, depending on which definition you use, you can actually delete this. So find a one-to-one correspondence between non-interactive message recognition protocols and digital signature schemes. I'm not going to cover that today, I'm just trying to be comprehensive. Also, we try to look at the Jane Doe protocol, the protocol that we just saw, and see what we can do to improve it. So stick with the same protocol and try to go around some of the issues. So there was a recoverability problem. We did some tricks and then added a resynchronization process to it. So whenever Alice and Bob were waiting for too long, or they suspected that something was going on, they could actually go and resynchronize. But then later we provided a self-recoverability notion to it and simplified the security assumption. So it's a little bit, it's not as messy as the original protocol, but still a hash chain. So still we are dealing with depth I versions of standard notions for hash function security. And then also we provided explicit confirmation for these protocols. That's when Alice sends something to Bob and knows that in the next round if Bob actually accepts it or not. But I'm not going to cover those either, and I'm going to talk about this part. So what about not using hashing at all? So we don't have to deal with those non-standard assumptions. So we're going to propose a message recognition protocol that uses keys, random keys for every message that are being refreshed at every session. Okay? And we're going to see another message recognition protocol design that uses more standard assumptions. And how do we do that? We actually combine this this technique here with the hash chain and get something that is based on the existence of pseudo-random functions. Okay, so as I said, I'm quickly moving on to the protocols. So this is something that is more useful for ad hoc pervasive networks because we're not using a hash chain, so we are low on memory. We don't have to store a lot of hash chain values. Also, the total number of the messages is flexible. We don't need to determine that to be the size of a hash chain because there is no hash chain. And the assumptions are a little bit relaxed. So the internal state of Alice and Bob is going to be this is Alice. Analogously, change every X to Y and Y to X and get Bob's internal state. So X0 and XY are the keys that are going to be as keys for the max, let's say. And capital X's are committing hash values. So hash of X0 and hash of X1 are the capital versions. And then we have a binding hash value. So instead of using a chain, we're binding the two values like this, using the same hash function. And we have to take care of the security assumption for this one, and we'll get to that. And then these are the recent, the star versions of Y's are Bob's most recent values that Alice has accepted. So analogously, change everything X's to Y's and Y's to X and get Bob's internal state. Okay, initialization phase of the algorithm, of the protocol, Alice and Bob are going to send the committing X0 and the binding X0 and Y analogously to each other. And then these are just what we saw in the previous slide. And then here is the protocol. Well, this is not actually the protocol. The protocol is this, but then let's see high level. Let's not get it too crowded. So this is similar to what we saw on input M. You're going to find a MAC of M under X0, send that to Bob. Bob is going to send, this is analogous to the B of BI of the previous session. And then the committing one and the binding one, the same. So Alice is going to verify Bob and send her own values to Bob, and Bob is going to verify and then verify the message, and then that's it. So this is the actual protocol. And then you see that if things didn't go right, there's an resynchronization process, which is this, but we don't want to look at the details now. Just there's a way that they can actually resynchronize if something went wrong. Okay, so what kind of security assumptions we're looking for here? So remember pre-image resistance? The challenger chooses a random Y0 and finds hash of that Y0, which is capital Y0, sends it to Oscar, and then Oscar is supposed to find Y0 prime such that Y0 prime hashes to capital Y0. That's not what we have. It's related, it's very similar, but it's not exactly that. So what we have is we're also sending this binding value, and then we're giving extra information, but we're also asking for extra information. So if we have that H is collision resistance, then we know that it's paired pre-image resistance. We know that. We've shown that. What? But we yet don't know if it's if there's a trivial, you know, equivalence or whatever between pre-image resistance, normal pre-image resistance, standard notion to this one. This is what we need. But it's a big step forward from the hashing scenarios, because here we're giving just one extra information, but they were giving I extra information. This is like depth 2, and they had depth I for every I from 1 to N. So although we're not yet basing this on standard assumptions, we're very close. Okay, so let's move on to the second category. So we want to push more randomness to the chains. Okay, so in the previous work, they were using chains but not enough randomness. In what I just showed in the previous slide, we were not using chains but we were introducing randomness at every session. Now we're just combining the both. So we're going to introduce new randomness per message and then basically get something down to pseudo-random functions. Okay, so this is the initialization of the protocol, let F be a pseudo-random function. And let's look at what Alice does. Alice chooses A0 to AN to be random. So previously, they only had A0 to be random. We have N random numbers, and then we have these alpha I's that are being replaced. They're actually replacing AIs from before. But what is alpha I is F of alpha I minus 1 and AI minus 1. Similarly for Bob, they're going to exchange Alice alphas and betas, and then this is the high level again. It's not the exact protocol. It's a high level version of the protocol. This is nothing new. This is what was going on in the previous slide as well. And then Bob is going to send beta I and B, where beta I and B, when you get them here, F of that is going to give you the I, beta I plus 1. So this is the condition instead of just having one input here. And the same here. And then if it verifies, Bob is going to check if A prime was actually the key. So if M prime is going to map to D prime under key A prime. Okay, so the natural question is that, okay, then what's the hash function game that you're dealing with here? And that's here. So Oscar and Challenger. Challenger is going to choose random R0 to RI. All of them are size S. It's going to let row 0 to be just a random R0. And then compute row J to be F of row J minus 1 and RJ for every J between 1 and I. And it's going to send Oscar the last one, row I, the last one. Okay, now Oscar's task is to find pi of size 2S such that F of pi is going to be row I, so pi is the preimage of row I. Again, this is not exactly the second, the preimage resistance game, because of several reasons. Because we're fixing the sizes here in the standard notions, you don't need to do that. And then also, row I has the target here is not exactly random. RJ is random. But there's a structure here. But because you're introducing randomness at every index J, we're able to prove something like this, which we're very happy with. So we consider a function f from 2s to s, and let I be a polynomial in s, so let I be a polynomial here, and then the function f is preimage resistant if and only if it is degree I preimage resistant, which is this one. And, well, this part hasn't been published anywhere. We just did it 2 weeks. We just finished writing up 2 weeks ago. And we think that it's a big step forward, because before this, either we were using very non-standard assumptions, or we were just exchanging too many bits of information that these little devices couldn't handle with. So I think I have to stop here. Well, that's fine.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
I could imagine you saying it.
I would say you think.